poignant fragility of family.
But I realize that they, in many, many ways, about the disintegration of the family in our time. And the painful awareness of what we thought was once truly permanent family was, in fact, very, very impermanent and was, in some ways, a fragile structure. So all the stories, and, you know, in various ways, point to that without my having intended it or consciously structured it that way.
That's novelist and short story writer Russell Banks. We talk with him about his new collection of short stories, A Permanent Member of the Family. And George Saunders just received the National Book Award for his story collection, 10th of December. We replay Drew Adamek's February 2013 interview with Saunders in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When writer Russell Banks was 12 years old, his father deserted the family. Perhaps that's why Banks is so attuned to the human need for connection and the fragility of family bonds whose permanence we take for granted. He also grew up on the poorer side of the working class. His sensitivity to the hidden injuries of class is an enduring feature of his work. Think of his novels Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, as well as the last novel we spoke with him about, Lost Memory of Skin. Banks's latest collection of stories, A Permanent Member of the Family, explores these themes, how people deal with the fraying of the ligaments of family and society that hold us together, both as individuals and as members of the whole. Russell Banks is the author of 12 novels and 6 story collections, as well as several works of poetry and nonfiction. Lost Memory of Skin won the Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter were made into films. Russell Banks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
The last time we spoke with you, it was about your wonderful novel, The Lost Memory of Skin. Now you have a collection of short stories, A Permanent Member of the Family, and it is your 6th collection. I wonder, do you actually have it right there with you?
Actually, I do.
Oh, good. And I wonder if you might just start out with you reading a little bit from the title story, A Permanent Member of the Family. And it will start on page 29, but I'd like you to set us up and tell us what's going on here. This story concerns a dog and the breakup of a marriage.
Right, and it begins where the narrator, who's looking back from many years later to the 70s when this occurred, and how with his 3 daughters and also from that marriage and a daughter from a previous marriage, who has been living with him, and he and his wife, soon to be ex-wife, have agreed, in as much as one can, in a situation like this, to share custody of the children, a somewhat radical event at that time. And they're doing fine. The kids are, you know, they've managed to work out the schedules, and the kids are back and forth, and everybody's kind of like functioning in a fairly peaceful way. And then it gets a little complicated because there are 2 animals in the family, a cat and a dog named Sarge, which is a female dog despite the name. And it's a little harder to have joint custody of animals and to explain to them how it's going to work. So the cat ends up choosing the narrator's house, which is just down the road from the ex-wife's. And the dog, at first, has to be, you know, carried back with the girls, the daughters, and back and forth between the 2 houses. But eventually the dog chooses to stay with the narrator, too. And then that starts to create custody problems, in a sense, a Solomaic problem. So that's the leading up to more or less where we're going to pick up everyone, me, Sarge, the girls. I think even Louise was relieved. We all knew on some level that a major battle, one with a likelihood of causing considerable collateral damage, had been narrowly avoided. Yet, despite my relief, I felt a buzzing, low-grade anxiety about having gained sole custody of Sarge. I wasn't aware of it then, but looking back now, I see that Sarge, as long as she was neither exclusively mine nor Louise's, functioned in our newly disassembled family as the last remaining link to our pre-separation, pre-lapsarian past, to a time of relative innocence, when all of us, but especially the girls, still believed in the permanence of our family unit, our pack. If Sarge had only agreed to traipse up and down the lane behind the girls, if she had agreed to accept joint custody, then my having left my wife could have been seen by all of us as an eccentric, impulsive, possibly even temporary sleeping arrangement. And for the girls, it could have been a bit like going on a continuous series of neighborhood camping trips with Dad. I would not have felt quite so guilty, and Louise would not have been so hurt and angry. The whole abandonment issue would have been ameliorated somewhat. The children would not have been so traumatized. Their lives, as they see them today, would not have been permanently disfigured. And neither Louise nor I might have gone looking so quickly for replacement spouses.
I love this story.
Good.
And we do have to tell our listeners that one of the issues is that Sarge is a very elderly dog.
Oh, yes. That's true.
And so can't really traipse back and forth all that easily.
No, an old arthritic dog that has to be lifted up to be put into the back of the station wagon and driven back up to the ex-wife's house on demand.
Now, this is a collection of a number of short stories. Why did you pick this one to be the title to in some way represent the whole collection?
Yeah, well, I think I didn't have a title for the book until they were all done. And I think I wrote this particular story somewhere about halfway into the group. I did write the entire book, you know, in a period of a year and a half after finishing the last novel, Lost Memory of Skin. And it was a period of intense story writing. And they, in a way, reflect my mind and emotions and stage of life, I guess, together in a more unified way than they might have if I had written them over a period of years, you know, a couple of stories here, then a novel, a couple there, and then drawn them together to collect. They were written more or less as a book. And only when I was looking back over them and thinking about, you know, I need a title, I mean, what am I going to call this book, that I realized that they, in many, many ways, about the disintegration of the family in our time. And the painful awareness of what we thought was once truly permanent family was, in fact, very, very impermanent and was, in some ways, a fragile structure, extremely fragile structure. So all the stories, and you know, in various ways, point to that without my having intended it or consciously structured it that way. I just could see, looking at them, you know, there's sometimes they're from the point of view of a child, sometimes they're from the point of view of a neighbor. Maybe it happened two generations back, or, you know, but there's always some breakup of the family somewhere lurking in there. And the attempts to recombine and rebuild a unit, a pack, as that story has it.
Yes, and these families are also, many of them, if perhaps not all of them, but many of them are dealing with also the breakup of the larger social family, people trying to hold on,
right.
You know, at times when it's very difficult to hold body and soul together.
Right, right. You know, there is that sense of the center has not held, the center being, you know, the community, the larger community. So the people in these stories are often very solitary, very alone in the world. You know, and there's a kind of loneliness, I think, that seems to come through most of the stories. Even, you know, even when there's intimacy, there seems to be a kind of loneliness. There's that story about the man in Miami at a, you know, plumbing supply convention in a hotel, and he runs into a woman that he almost went to bed with 5 years earlier. They have this sort of meeting, and he remembers that whole event finally 5 years earlier, and the lonely moment where he almost crossed over out of himself and into a kind of embrace of, you know, an intimacy with this woman, and almost broke his solitude, and he's looking back, and she's looking back, and he realizes that he didn't break it. He didn't step out and cross that line. You know, on the one hand, he was a good husband. He didn't commit adultery. On the other hand, he lost something too. And that story is I kind of like that story, but partly because it's the loneliness in the story is sort of, it's like an Edward Hopper loneliness, you know. The man standing by the window in the hotel room with a glass of wine in his hand and the woman sitting on the bed, you know, taking off her shoes and nothing about to happen.
Yeah, and also was quite haunted by the story, former Marine. Here we have a man who, you know, pretends he's retired. He's not really retired. A former Marine named Connie, who ends up in a hospital bed with a secret about to be blown. And he's gotten involved with crime, not because he's a bad man, but because he is actually trying to hew to a moral code, to be the head of his family, to be the dad.
Yeah, and he forces that are he can't control that are larger than he have thrown him down, tossed him to the ground, and he's a man. He has to act like a certain kind of man, and he's got three sons who are law enforcement officers and people he's proud of, and he wants to look good too, and so on. Yeah, it's a story of a breakdown too, economic breakdown in our world, and its consequences, you know, on lives of ordinary folks, you know, who are, in this case, a man in his 60s who suddenly is unemployed and in debt and proud. And that's a hard combination.
And three sons who are all in law enforcement one way or the other,
right,
who are now confronted with a moral dilemma of their own.
Right, exactly. You know, that story actually has its origins in a news clipping that I think I clipped it probably 5 years ago or a good long while ago. And it was in my notebooks. I was going through, you know, before I started writing these stories, I went through all my notebooks for the last few years just to see, because I have been making sketches and notes and ideas for stories for a while. And I found this clip, and it was, I think it was in Illinois or Indiana. It was out in the Midwest somewhere. A story about a father, a man in late middle age or early old age, who had ended up, and I'm not giving too much away here in the story, ended up robbing banks. And his sons, who weren't necessarily law enforcement, I think one of them was, found out that he was robbing banks, and they had to confront him. And when I read the clipping, and I think the reason I held on to it is because it pointed toward an encounter, a meeting between a father and his sons. And I said, there's a story in that meeting. It isn't like the fact that the father's robbing bank is not the story. The story is in the meeting and the meaning of that meeting and how it unfolds between the sons and the father and the conflict that they all are feeling. And that was sort of what you write toward. You write toward that moment in the story. And then what follows from that moment is the rest of the story.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with celebrated novelist Russell Banks about his new collection of stories, A Permanent Member of the Family. You just mentioned notes and notebooks and clippings. Could you talk a little bit just about the process of gathering the material for short stories like this, which must be somewhat different than gathering material for a novel?
Yes, it's very different, it seems. In some ways, you're writing songs, and when you're writing a novel, it's like you're writing an opera. The scale changes everything, but, you know, so does the relation to the music, to the language changes. And stories are much closer to poems, I think, than they are to novels, both in terms of course, brevity, but also musicality of stories is closer. So the relation to language is different than it is with a novel. And their relation to form, too, because it's more objectified. In a sense, you can be conscious of the form of a story in a way you're not, or you're rarely conscious of it with a novel. But anyhow, I can't say I have a pattern, although I probably do, and somebody else can detect it more easily than I can, but a pattern of where I begin and why I begin a story or a particular place or with a particular image or a situation or characters, because it varies enormously. Sometimes it is a newspaper clipping like the one I just mentioned in former Marine, that story. And sometimes it's, you know, something that actually happened in my life or maybe something I vaguely remember, but I remember an image and an occasion going back. Or it might be something I heard in a conversation or it might be just an image. And you just, you know, don't know where it's going to lead. The thing that I love about story writing, in a sense, is that it's always very specific beginning. I always know in a funny way, how a story is going to begin. I mean, something attracts me. It could be an image. It could be a situation. It could be a sentence that sounds particularly engaging and sexy to me. It could be a character or someone that I'm just drawn to in some way or other. But I don't know where it's going to go, but I just trust the process to teach me where it's going to go and show me as I write where it's going to go. So it's kind of it's a great short-term adventure, and I love it. After a while, I'm eager to get back into the novel world, but that's a different kind of mentality for me, a different kind of adventure. Requires a lot of research, often planning, much more planning, and much more care and commitment. It's a long-term relationship. When you start a novel, you're going to be there for 3 to 5 years, whereas the story is a little bit of a dalliance in a way. You think, oh, good, I'll write this story and I'll be done with it in 2 weeks or something like that. It's rather nice.
And could you say more about the different relationship to the musicality of a language?
Well, I think, with a story, if you think about what happens when you read a short story, usually, when you get to the end of the story, it makes sense mainly if you can still remember the beginning. It's as if there was a kind of echo or rhyme operating between the beginning and the end of a story. And if you can't remember the beginning, chances are the story doesn't quite make sense, or it's too contrived, or it's too tricky. The plot has just tricked you instead of really unfolded before you. So there is that sense of that like in a sonata, a musical sense, or in a song. When you get to the end of a song, you can often still hear the first opening bars in your ear, and it makes the last closing bars more emotionally evocative, let's say. And I think most songwriters are conscious of that. And I think, story writers tend to be that way, too. In fact, I think that that's almost a rule of story writing, is that it shouldn't be any longer such that you forget the beginning when you get to the end. I mean, what Edgar Allan Poe famously described the proper length of a story was that it could be read at one sitting. In a way, he was sort of describing the same phenomenon, that if it's any longer than what it takes for one sitting, you might forget how it began. And if you forget how it began, then you're moving into novel territory. You're starting to imitate the flow of time in a way that a novel does. And the flow of time is such that you can't remember the beginning, the flow of time in your life. We don't remember the beginning of our life. Just as in a novel, once you get to be about page 70 or 80, chances are very good you can't remember where it began,
right,
the opening scene was. Just as in life.
And you mentioned also before that sometimes there are events in your own life, and there is one story in here where the narrator, it's Veronica is a story,
yeah,
where the narrator is named Russell.
Right.
Did that happen to you?
Well, I've used my own name before in the past in fiction, attached it to essentially a fictional character. In Rule of the Bone, a novel, the main character, Bone, has a pal named Russell, and it's a side of myself. I know, I'm very aware of when I was young. He's a 16-year-old wise guy, a kind of a Tom Sawyer character who seems to explain everything to everybody, and oftentimes, he pretends to or seems to know more than he really does, and so he gets himself and other people in trouble sometimes. Not quite reliable person. Anyhow, it's a side of myself, and I just sort of projected that into that character, the side of myself that I probably was embarrassed by and hid from most of my adult life, and finally got old enough where I could forgive that kid and find him amusing. And so I used my own name to kind of exorcise him in a sense. But in the case of the story you mentioned, which is Searching for Veronica, the auditor, the person who's listening to the story, is being told by a woman that he's met in a bar in an airport. She's compulsively telling him this story, and he's mainly listening, and then he gradually starts asking a few questions that the reader might ask to keep her going, because her story's getting interesting and complicated. He's sort of engaged and intrigued by it and all. And only at the very end does his name come into it, Russell. And there's a flip that happens at that point in the story. I don't want to get into too many details, but it isn't as though that happened to me. In fact, only, it's happened to lots of people. It happened to me many times. I've ended up in a bar, waiting to go somewhere, and airport, my plane is late or whatever, and someone starts talking my ear off and turns out to be rather interesting. I mean, that happens all the time. So in that sense, yes, sure, it's based on that. But what I was really doing was something else, though, was by putting my own name in, substituting, in a sense, myself or character like myself for the reader, who is also listening to this woman tell her story and believing it and then maybe questioning it and then not quite believing it and then feeling, wait a minute, what's real here and why am I being led along here by this person? And so I think it was a kind of way of affirming an identification with and intimacy with the reader of the story. By putting my own name and character, in a sense, in there. I mean, I knew the reader would say, oh, yeah, right, this is a story by Russell Banks, and he's made it himself part of the story. Now, do I really believe it's by Russell Banks, and this is Russell, the narrator? Because that's one of the themes that the story is exploring, that the woman's telling you. You have to say, is this really the woman she says she is? Is she really searching for Veronica? And is Veronica who she says she is? And so forth. It's a story that, in a way, is about the suspension of disbelief. And when do we do it, and why do we do it, and is it useful, or is it sometimes dangerous?
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with writer Russell Banks about his new short story collection, A Permanent Member of the Family.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. And then there was another one in which I thought I could possibly discern the real author behind the story, perhaps more than others, maybe because I could really identify with it too. And that's the one, Big Dog. It's it's about a guy who finds out that he gets a MacArthur Genius Grant, and then he goes to a dinner event with a number of friends where they all find out, and the, you know, all the jealousies, the envy that arises, and I could totally relate to that myself, and I wondered if that's where you were coming from too.
Well, yeah, the insecurity too that he starts to feel because he says, oh, Jesus, you know, he knows secretly that he doesn't really deserve it, in a sense. Nobody I think he's one line in there. He says, nobody deserves MacArthur. And he knows that. On the other hand, he really wants to deserve it. You know, he wants to think, hey, come on, I'm a genius. So it also reveals that evening confrontation, reveals his fears and anxieties and insecurities. And then he's, it's called Big Dog because he's the big dog. It's his wife's nickname for him. But then gradually, the irony of the story is this young kid who's there at the dinner, who's himself never finished a novel, slowly takes over the dominance of the so-called big dog, and he becomes the big dog at the end of the story. But it is a situation. No, I've never been in that situation, not having received a MacArthur, but I have been in lots of situations like that where somebody got a big award, and you could just see the congratulations are somewhat larded with envy, anger, a little bit of bitterness, and so forth, especially in the academic world.
Exactly. then there was another one, Snowbirds, which I really enjoyed because it took something that happens, turned it on its head, and then made you realize that it wasn't about the person that you thought it was about.
Right.
Could you say a little bit about that story?
Yeah, it's at first you think it's about the new widow whose husband has suddenly died, and they've gone to Florida, and he's suddenly died. And she's suddenly liberated in a funny way, and unexpectedly, as a result of her husband's death. And her friend comes to comfort her, woman friend, comes down from the north and stays with her to comfort her, begins to see the fact that this other woman, the widow, is suddenly liberated by the death of her husband. And it starts to challenge the woman's view of her own marriage. And that's when it starts to switch, and you start tracking, not the widow, but you start to track the friend. And it's about halfway through the story, I think, it starts to shift, and you realize, oh, wait, the center of gravity for this story, the person is going through an emotional transition that's really interesting and important and that she doesn't quite grasp yet, is in the friend's life. And that's what I wanted. I mean, I've seen that happen before. It happens sometimes in divorces and as well, you know, or death of a spouse or something like that, where you think the person's going to go through hell and you go to help and comfort them and you suddenly realize, whoa, this looks like fun. maybe I could have a little of that or something. I've seen that happen before. So the story is an attempt to kind of dramatize that condition, that situation.
It struck me that these stories in A Permanent Member of the Family, you know, you said before a short story is like a poem. I thought they were almost like an illustration, that you can do something with a short story. You know, in a novel, they're just so, you know, you get involved in the lives. I mean, and the arc is so much longer. But in this, it's like they're making you think about something. As you've been describing these stories, they make you think about a point of view, it may be, or just a shift, or do you know what I'm trying to say? It's like an illustration of something.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they are moments. A good story, I think, delivers a couple of moments in a life that occur in a way that makes what follows from that moment different from what led up to that moment. And we sometimes go through our lives without being conscious of being in those moments, even though, of course, we are all the time. And we don't realize it sometimes till years later, if at all. We wake up one morning and our life has changed, and we weren't even aware of it changing in the process. Whereas with a story, you can focus in on those moments in a way and imply the past and also at the same time imply the future. The story, you know, that you mentioned earlier, too, about, that woman, Snowbirds, when that woman goes back, the friend goes back home to her husband in the Adirondacks, in that small town in the north, that her marriage is going to be different than it was before she left. And she's going to have a different relation to her husband, not altogether happy relationship to the husband, but a more conscious one, at least. In some ways, I feel that the best stories, at least the ones I love and remember, are stories in which a character becomes, you know, quickly, in a moment or two, more conscious, more aware than he or she was at the beginning of the story. And it can happen, you know, in very small increments. All of a sudden, then, after an accumulation of increments, there can be a shift and a change, as it does with that friend in the story. Snowbirds. It's small increments of awareness, starting when she first gets off the plane in Miami and her friend shows up in a Chrysler convertible. You know, that's not a Subaru. And she suddenly starts to have to adapt and change a little bit, first to her friend and then to herself. And it's very hard to do that with a novel. I mean, a novel, as I was saying earlier, you know, in a way, a novel imitates the flow of time in some ways. Those little moments, you can't build a novel out of, you know, those moments, those little moments. You need thousands of them.
Well, this is a delightful collection and one that was very thought-provoking. A Permanent Member of the Family, Russell Banks. This has just been a delight to talk with you about it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking about it with you.
Russell Banks. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our previous interviews with him about his novels Lost Memory of Skin and The Reserve. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next up, George Saunders talks about 10th of December. It just won the National Book Award. Stay tuned.
The Beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars. Restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Last February, Writer's Voice associate producer Drew Adamack interviewed one of his favorite authors, George Saunders, about his latest collection of stories, 10th of December. The book was just announced as a finalist for the National Book Awards, so we thought it'd be a good time to hear that interview again. Here's Drew.
George Saunders is a giant of American fiction. Last month, the New York Times called him the writer for our times. He's a MacArthur Fellow, he's won the National Magazine Award for Fiction 4 times, and his work is widely anthologized. His work is so original, is such a masterful blending of genres, and written with such skill that it defies easy explanation. He expertly captures the cadences and nuances of language to create characters that repel and attract in equal measure. He combines shock and dismay with wit and sensitivity, and a pitch-perfect voice with an unbelievably deft touch. It is almost impossible to read a George Saunders story without being moved. The bulk of Saunders' writing takes the short story form, although he has also published a novella called The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, a children's book called The Very Persistent Gippers of Fripp, and a collection of essays called The Braindead Megaphone. His new book, 10th of December, is his 4th collection of short stories. Called the best book you'll read this year, this deeply moving, yet nervously dark, collection of 10 stories, most of which first appeared in The New Yorker, is a wide-ranging indictment of our consumer culture and a chronicle of disconnected loneliness filled with unforgettable and expertly drawn characters. The stories in 10th of December range from Victory Lap, in which a pair of socially disparate teenagers confront a sudden act of violence, to Home, in which a soldier who committed war crimes in Iraq and is suffering from PTSD returns home to find that his domestic situation pushes him to the brink, to the title story, in which a misfit 10-year-old boy and an older man dying of cancer face their deaths together in a frozen forest preserve. I recently spoke to Mr. Saunders about his new collection, why the short story is such a powerful storytelling tool for him, and the futility of talking about writing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, will you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this collection, 10th of December, and how the stories that were selected were included in this book?
Sure. I mean, you know, my books, this is my 4th collection, and they've all kind of been written the same way, which is I kind of just, you know, start. I just start writing one story, and then that story usually raises some questions or kind of burns me out on a certain stylistic approach and produces another one and so on. So then at the end of a certain period, I start to feel like it's almost a collection. In this case, it was 6 or 7 years. Then you just kind of, you know, wait for the last word to be finished. And then there's a kind of an intense period of ordering and reordering and cutting some out and that kind of thing. But it's I kind of just feel my way towards what constitutes a collection. I don't have a big, you know, plan at the beginning or any kind of outline or anything like that. Very intuitive.
And how would you describe the stories themselves for a listener or a reader who's not familiar with your work, the 10 stories that are included in this collection?
Well, I would describe them as great. You have to buy them. No, I would say...
Award-winning.
Award-winning, yes, yes, addictive. No, they're kind of dark, actually. You know, my method, for whatever reason, is to make a kind of a difficult situation or a situation where somebody gets tested morally and then kind of turn up the heat and basically almost like a lab experiment, you know, trying to see how people behave under duress. So I think for a kind of new reader, someone new to my work, they would strike you as being pretty severe, I guess, in some ways, but also they're ostensibly funny. And I hope their reader would feel kind of a loving presence behind all of it, kind of stage managing it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing. I'm not real articulate about what the stories do, but I kind of know it when I feel it. Like, as I'm working on them, I kind of feel pretty close to them and pretty in control. And then I step back, and I'm not sure what to say about them, really.
This is your 4th collection of short stories, and you've also published a nonfiction collection and a children's book and a novella and no novels. What is it about the short story form that's so powerful and so necessary for you?
You know, the honest answer is, it just, I just, have strong opinions about short form stuff. If I'm writing something that's, you know, 8 pages, I have a very strong idea of what needs to be done. But when I push off into these longer forms that are 70, 80, 90, 100, 200 pages, I just, it's not like I get lost, but I just kind of lose my opinion about them. You know, it's almost like I can see short form things very clearly, and I'm decisive about them. But when it gets past a certain length, I kind of lose my aesthetic compass a little bit. So I've had a couple of things that were long, and I just said, you know, that's actually not meant to be that long, and I cut it back. So the analogy I sometimes use is it might be a little bit like, you know, they describe athletes as having fast or slow twitch muscles, and I think I just have in my aesthetic muscle in writing is kind of fast twitch for whatever reason.
As a reader of this collection, I really got the sense that a lot of these stories, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I took away from this with these stories were about half of them were about language and the inability of our modern language and our modern culture to communicate and connect effectively. Is that something that you've put into these stories, and is that something that you've considered as you were writing them?
I think it's a good reading of them, but my experience is that language is kind of the way I navigate through a story. It's the way I keep my own interest up. So if, for example, if I'm writing in a certain diction and it starts to bore me, I'll always find some way to get out of that diction and into another one. So I think you're absolutely right as a sort of critical analysis. In the actual execution, it tends to be a little more pragmatic and a little more seat of the pants. You know, you feel like, God, I'm tired of writing this voice. Let me swerve over here. Or, for example, there's a story in the book called Escape from Spiderhead where, you know, one of the risks is that there's a drug that you take and it makes you more articulate. And that just came out of the fact that I'd written 3 or 4 stories in kind of a low-key, almost minimalist diction, and I was just kind of tired of it. So at some point I thought, man, I really want to write in a higher register. So then the drug just becomes kind of a trick, really, a vehicle, you know, to get you to do this. So I think in the execution, I'm not thinking that overtly about the issues that you're mentioning, but I think what you're saying is completely valid nonetheless.
And that's something that really strikes me about this collection, not just this collection, but your writing in general, is your ability to tap into different dictions. And there's, for example, the story Victory Lap. You write from 3 very different voices, and yet you capture them, in my mind, so perfectly. I mean, they're just pitch perfect. How do you open yourself up and find those disparate voices and make them so clear?
Well, that's a great question. The closest I could come to being truthful is that I try to approach it in a spirit of fun. In other words, to try to find, kind of look around and see what voice would be fun at the moment, meaning what voice is kind of full in me at that moment. And then kind of allow myself to play. There's a lot of drafting in those, you know, like kind of false starts and revisions and so on. So I think probably the truth is it's sort of a natural ability. Like when I was a kid, I used to do that. We'd make up characters and different voices and even different backstories and stuff. So it's kind of just enjoyable, really. You know, I know for me, I had a big breakthrough when I was about 30, where I went from thinking that writing was sort of this laborious, careful, intellectual thing to sort of remembering that it could also be an entertainment, both for reader and writer. It could be a sort of joy. So those voices are just really fun. You know, I kind of just, and of course, part of the exercise too is to say, okay, I've made a 15-year-old girl. Now I'm making a 15-year-old boy, and I have to distinguish him from her so they don't run into each other. Then it just becomes a bit of strategy. Like, well, she has this turn of phrase. She has to have a different one. She has this psychology. She has to be distinguishable. So I mostly, when I'm not able to do voices is when I'm trying to stage manage it too much and make the voices functional, you know, make them sort of serve the story. But when it does work is when I can say, oh, the hell with it, and just start riffing, you know. Then a character will appear, and often a character wants something or does something that actually causes plot to happen. And that's a really, you know, when that happens, I'm always glad about it because that's sort of a natural progression.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Today, I'm talking to writer George Saunders about his new story collection, 10th of December. You mentioned fun, and a lot of the writing about your work mentions humor and mentions, in some ways, satire. But I find in my reading of this, a lot of these stories, about half of these stories, I find a real sadness in that. And how do you balance that? And what's the approach to balancing the sadness and the humor?
Well, I think they're so closely related, don't you? I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I got really sad. I would kind of rev myself up by trying to make somebody laugh. Or often, you know, when you're in a state of happiness, you're kind of aware that it won't last. And so I think maybe for me, one of the tricks is to not think of those things as diametrically opposed. You know, I mean, obviously there is such a thing as happiness, and there's sadness, and there's tragedy. But somehow I think if you disable that binary a little bit as you're working, then it's more kind of like you're doing minute to minute whatever you need to do to keep the reader's interest. So this is sort of a crude way of saying it, but let's say that I've gotten on two really funny riffs in a row, and I know the reader's laughing. Well, in a way, that's kind of like she's a little bit vulnerable now for me to slip in something a little more dark or serious. Then when you do that, the whole story hops up a level. Suddenly it's a funny story that's about something serious. Or conversely, if you just put something really dark and hard to process in there, something dangerous, you can destabilize the story by then leaning on that in a slightly funny way. So it's a little bit like riding a bike. You know, you're how do you decide to lean left or right? Well, the first thing is to be really aware of where you are in relation to your reader, and then do the intuitive thing, you know. So it's, you know, in a funny way, the answer is you do it line by line. You sort of see where you are and then adjust accordingly, if that makes sense.
It does, and that brings me back to something that I wanted to ask about as far as intentionality in some of these stories, and something that you had mentioned earlier about creating sort of difficult or dark situations. And again, in my reading, and I'm sure other people take other things away from this, is these are characters, particularly like the story Al Roston or Escape from Spiderhead, these are characters that have been assigned roles either by their circumstances or their biology that they're trying to break out, and it's really about trying to break out of the roles that we have been assigned. Is that something that you set out to address?
No, but when you say that really resonates with me, and it makes sense. I think, you know, only because I was, as you were saying that, I thought, oh, I never thought of it that way. And isn't that kind of true of all of us? I mean, you know, I think you start out on life and you are trapped a little bit by your neurology, by your habits, by your biology, maybe by your class and your culture or whatever. And I think you can see life as kind of a long process of trying to get free of certain things and relax into others. And even if you want to go deeper than that, I would argue that we're born a little bit screwed up. Maybe this is original sin, and that we're born thinking, one, that we're central to everything. The world wasn't here until we were. Second, that we're permanent. You know, that we're going to be here forever. And third, that our narrative is the central narrative. Like, you know, we're what it's all about. And then, you know, as you get older, you gradually, hopefully, anyway, you work your way out of that trap. You know, you realize, oh, actually, I'm not going to be here forever. I'm not central. And the world, you know, was going before I got here and will continue afterwards. So at least my experience of life has been trying to make that accommodation in a way that didn't fill you with despair, that correctly oriented you to the rest of the world. So I think in like Al Roston and Spiderhead, you get people with exaggerated cases of that, just as you put it. You know, they're in a situation where they're under extreme constraint. Their selfhood is somehow flailing there at the bottom of this deep well, and it wants to get out. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I can't say that I intended it. But as I said, you know, I don't think, for me, intentionality is something I really try to suspend till the very end of the story, or only apply it in the smallest possible way. Like, okay, this guy is doing this action. Do I prefer him to do action A or action B? But the big sort of thematic intentionality, I just found earlier that if I do that, it trips me up. The stories end up being too reductive. So I try to trick myself and not have that intentionality get into it if I can do it. You know, I think your reading is absolutely correct, but for me, I don't get to a point where a reader could analyze a story unless I suspend intentionality as long as I can.
I'm Drew Adamek, and this is Writer's Voice, and I am talking to George Saunders, author of the new story collection, 10th of December. back to that idea, though, in a story like Home, which is so powerful and yet political at the same time, it's a powerful narrative and a powerful story, but also deeply political. Is that something that happens then on accident, or do you see a headline, or do you say, boy, this Iraq war really irks me, or PTSD really irks me, and I want to write about that? And for people who have not read the story, it's the story of a young soldier who comes home who may or may not have committed atrocities overseas and finds that the dysfunction at home sets him up to react, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, you did. I think for me, you know, the best description I can give is you kind of just you get close to a thing and you can feel that there's going to be energy there. And at that point, you approach very respectfully and you say, I don't know what exactly you're trying to tell me, but I can feel that there's some potential here. So in that case, it was just years ago I read Heracles, that play by Euripides, and it was right at the beginning of the Iraq War, and I thought, oh, that's an incredible parable for war, you know, for a guy coming home from war. And then in the intervening years, I kept saying, oh, yeah, I should try to do a version of that updated. And in that time, I sort of forgot the story and kind of messed it up in my mind. So I just one night I was just thinking, yeah, I've got nothing to do. Let's try that war story, and kind of just started kind of reconstructing what I could remember of Heracles. And, you know, I'm a left-wing guy, and I was not crazy about that war. But at the same time, what happens is as you're working on a story, it becomes less about an issue. It has to become less about an issue and more about the actual individual that you made. So what might start out to be vaguely political quickly under the discipline of revision becomes more and more and more about a specific individual. And my contention would be that that's really the only way a story can work, is to be about an individual that you've created. And the story has to be respectful of what you've, you know, what you've made. So in a certain way, it feels political, but I think it's a bit like a story that tries to be political is a little bit like a hammer made out of jello. I mean, logically, it can't be political because you're the puppeteer, you know. But in the best case, a story about a political issue reminds us that there aren't political issues. There are only personal issues. You know, personal issues writ large would be political. So in that one, I hope that you feel sympathy for the guy, and I hope you also feel a little surprised that you're feeling sympathy for a guy who, in my mind, did commit atrocities. And then if that happens, you're in that wonderfully complicated space where you have to suspend judgment, which to me is kind of a holy place to be, if only for a couple of minutes a day.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. You come from, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, you come from a very sort of blue-collar background. I shouldn't say very, but you come from a blue-collar background without all the sort of the educational bells and whistles in the beginning that we're told that a writer needs to have now. How does that influence your writing and influence your approach to writing, or am I completely misreading that and way off base?
No, I mean, I don't know if it was, I don't know if I'd call it blue collar. It's kind of hard to, it was the south side of Chicago and kind of a really interesting suburban neighborhood that we had cement contractors, and my dad was he was a salesman who became the vice president of this coal company, and we had somebody who was in for Wrigley. So I'm not quite sure how to characterize that neighborhood, but in my 20s, especially, I kind of, after college, I kind of fell off the wagon and ended up being working all these kind of weird jobs and got some insights into, you know, kind of what it's like to be not affluent, I guess, you know, you could say. And I was an engineer. I went to college for geophysical engineering. So I think that, I mean, really the short story would be that it just got me into a lot of situations that I wouldn't have been in otherwise, you know, both being broke, working, like I worked at the slaughterhouse for a while, I worked as a roofer. So I think that was all just kind of good grist for the mill to sort of know different sides of America, so that when you go to invent something, you kind of feel like you have some authority. You know, I feel like if I want to write about what it's like to be down on your luck, I kind of know that, you know. And conversely, you know, I've been lucky since to sort of get to travel in higher circles and do different things. It taught me a little bit more about the, you know, the higher reaches of America. So I think part of your job as a writer is to just get a real intuitive sense of what your country is like and what the range of possibilities is. So then when you go to make something up, you're not just, well, in a sense, you know, it kind of upends your sense of intentionality. Suddenly you're not really out to demonstrate a point, but you're out to be somewhat faithful to this complicated world that you've been running around in all these years.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Today, I'm talking to writer George Saunders about his new story collection, 10th of December. In saying that you're traveling in higher circles now, I've read that you said you can't really talk about writing, yet you've become a person for whom everybody wants to talk about writing too, and I mean, New York Times just the New York Times just called you, you know, a writer for our times. How do you balance that, and how do you deal with that demand as the popularity and demands on your time and expertise with the need to withdraw as a writer?
Well, I think you can talk about writing, but it's hard. It's hard to talk in a non-BS way about it. It's easy to talk reductively and say, oh, yes, you know, I meant to do that, or, you know, I had in mind that I would do blah, blah, blah. For me, that would be a false way of talking about it. So the trick is to kind of do what we're doing here, which is, you know, to kind of go into that gauzy territory where you're trying to describe something that's fundamentally mysterious. And I think mostly what I'm finding out is, you know, I like to be alone and I like to work. So if I can balance the public part of the job, the teaching and the whatever else, it's just getting the mix right, really. You know, I think if a person ends up being public too much of the time, then they're just going to erode their talent, I think. So I've just, you know, it hasn't really been an issue up until this last few months, and suddenly I can see where you could easily, you know, end up spending a lot of time talking about it and not much time doing it. So then I think it's just self-discipline, you know, to say, we're going to get the mix right, and we're going to talk about it for one unit of time and do it for 20, and then it'll be all right.
I want to go back again and ask about a specific story in the collection, and I may pronounce this correctly, and forgive me if I do, but I think probably the most powerful story in this collection for me is the Semplica Girl Diaries. Will you talk about that, the genesis of that story and how it came to be and what that story means to you now?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is kind of an embarrassing answer, but I just dreamed it. I dreamed the central image of that story way back, like in 98, I think it was. And, you know, usually you dream something and you wake up and you go, oh, that's ridiculous. It's a terrible idea. But this one kind of stuck with me. So, a couple days later, I just jotted down a couple, thoughts about it, and then I think I just let it gestate for a week or two, and then, you know, the whole thing was how could I make a world in which that central image occurred naturally, and so I started just kind of, for some reason, I've been reading this book called I Will Bear Witness by Victor Klemperer, and it's an incredible diary of the Holocaust, and by a guy who lives in Dresden, and it's a real sneaky book because he doesn't know it's the Holocaust, you know, he just thinks it's a temporary disturbance. So it's somebody had written in a review that it's the one account of the Holocaust that feels like it's in color, you know. And so I thought, oh, that'd be interesting to try to tell this story in the diary form. So I just started, and it unfortunately it took 12 years to get the whole thing finished. I had a lot of sort of, you know, I blundered off the path a few times. I didn't realize it, and so I guess. For me, the main thing was to try to make it believable, to make it this really outrageous and kind of dark central image, not seem like a contrivance, not seem like a clever thematic device or something, but make it seem like something that could actually happen. And what I found out was that combined with the diary is a deadly combination. And it just took a ton of trying to get it where it felt both like a diary and felt sort of real, sort of naturalistic, if you will.
And not to leave our listeners in the dark, would you be willing to describe that central image of that story?
Yeah, sure. I dreamed that I got out of bed and walked to this window in our house. It actually doesn't exist, but the window in my dream looked out into the backyard. And in the backyard, there were these four women that I understood to be poor women from third world countries, and they were sort of like suspended in our yard with a wire that went right through their heads. So they were all four, like almost like paper dolls on a line. And they were wearing these long white smocks, and they all had long black hair, and they were perfectly happy to be there. They weren't hurt. They weren't in pain. They were just out there like long arms. And the weird part of the dream was that the person I was in the dream wasn't outraged or disgusted, but was just deeply content. Like, I remember thinking, the guy in the dream was thinking, oh, we finally made it. You know, finally I can give this wonderful thing to my kids. So it was a world in which those things were kind of a status symbol. So, I mean, you know, that was like, to have that dream is not, it's a little bit unnerving. But then, so I thought, okay, so that's interesting. And how did he get there? Like, how what kind of world is it where that could happen? So then it's just a 12-year journey of trying to sort of piece together that the logistics of that world. The thing that I'm, you know, as I'm on this tour, I'm struggling to do is to be truthful about how the stories get written without being too clever about it, you know, without being too reductive, because for me it really is about the iterations. You know, like if you write 400 drafts of something, all kinds of magical things can happen that you never could have predicted at the outset. You know, so my understanding of my job as a writer is to do the 400 drafts with a relatively kind of light touch and open mind, and then let the story kind of change under my hands until it gets sufficiently interesting. And that, in a way, that's kind of a hard thing to talk about. You know, all of the things you said are totally valid, I think, and interesting, critically, provocative. But my conundrum is that if I had thought about those things too early, I would have jeopardized the story's health in a certain way. And the more sophisticated version, Einstein said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. So if you apply those to a story, it's just what you said. If you know what you're going to do at the outset, then the worst thing that could happen to you is that you could succeed. Because I think the reader then feels the condescension in that, right? Because you started out to do something, and it didn't really matter where the actual energy of the story was. It didn't matter what you were evoking in the reader. You were just dead set to get to your thing, you know? And that is bound to leave the reader feeling a little bit miffed, I think, you know, or bored, even worse.
I want to thank you not only for your time here, but also for our audience. I have a little story. I was at a panel at which you were speaking in, I believe, 2011 in New York, and there was a moratorium on approaching the authors after the panel. But I noticed that after everyone was done speaking, there were some folks getting autographs, and I had a copy of one of your books. But it appeared that the folks that you were talking to were family members, so I sort of decided to leave you alone, and I went into the lobby and used the restroom. And when I came out, you came over to me and said, "Hey, I noticed you waiting to get a book signed. Can I sign something for you?" And you were very, very gracious with your time then, and you have been very gracious and open with your time now. So I want to say very, very sincerely, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you I don't remember that, but I'm glad I did it. Maybe I thought you owed me some money or something.
I look like the kind of person that would owe people money, so it's absolutely an accurate read on your part.
Well, thank you for today. I enjoyed our talk very much.
Drew Adamek talking with George Saunders about 10th of December. It just won the National Book Award. The interview originally aired in February 2013. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.